Hello, and welcome to Down to Sally's Cove, a collection of stories about Newfoundland and Labrador by the late L. Emanuel and read by me, Anthony Berger. I'm the editor of my mother's writings about the history and rich culture of the places and people she knew and loved. Many of these stories she read on local and national radio in the 1940s to 1970s. In this second of four episodes describing a typical year in mid-century Bombay, L. Emanuel tells of watching a house being moved, launches her new Rodney, entertains the Rockefellers, and joins a grand party in the old Orange Lodge. It was a summer of wonders. One evening late in June, my friend M. Tapper and I were sitting at the kitchen table. The sun had set and darkness crept over the calm black water of Bombay. Although we did not quite define it as such, we were talking of values, of what we thought was worthwhile in life, of what other people apparently thought worthwhile. Just talking rather aimlessly, one thing bringing another to our minds. I remembered a man who once said to me, "If I went blind tomorrow, I'd have enough sights in my memory to keep me happy the rest of my life." And he wasn't 50 then. "As for me," I said, "if somebody told me I could either have $500 or the day on Western Brook that we had last week, I'd take Western Brook any day. No amount of money could buy for me any material thing that could be half as precious as the day of sun and wind when for 2 hours we walked the bank of the river, waded through its waters, ploughed through the marsh, and saw sights that were like gems in my mind's eye. My whole summer was like that, day after lovely day, clouds chasing each other through a blue sky, shadows racing across the brown tablelands, changing their colour every moment. Gross morn sometimes a soft blue, shot with green, other times a slate grey, the bay every colour that water could show. And there was always the sound of a brook, or the waves on the beach, or the wind stirring the leaves wherever you went." It was a July morning that summer when Harvey told me that Mansell was going to launch his house, and that was something I shouldn't miss. I nearly did, though, for launching day was so warm and sunny that I weeded the garden, and by the time I started for the village the house was already several hundred feet along the road. There it faced me, completely blocking the way, like a derelict schooner accidentally beached. The house is 30 feet by 40 feet, 2 stories tall, flat roof, with 2 big brick chimneys protruding. The front door was open, and one of Mansell's boys sat on the step, grinning. On the roof was John Jellicoe, a cigarette hanging from his lower lip as he leaned over to grasp an electric wire that stretched over the road at this point. 2 tractors, held together by a steel cable, were hauling the house, which rested on skids so huge that I would have thought they'd have to go to British Columbia to find logs as big as those. But Mansell had found them in his winter wanderings deep in a gully behind the village. 9/10 of the village were on hand that day. Everyone was yelling, so the tractors suddenly stopped. It was obvious that the chimneys would not pass under the wire. Consternation, profanity, much spitting, along with gratuitous advice from below, and John Jellicoe's bellow from above. "Hey, send some fellers up with me, we'll raise her up." Then a grin broke over his face. From his vantage point, he could see a figure flying down a back lane. "Oi, there's Everett, we'll be okay now." Everett, the electricity expert who'd been north on a job, had arrived home at 5 that morning. Everybody said this was providence. The wires properly loosened, lifted by 20 hands, went tightly and smoothly over the chimneys. Men yelled, the tractors took up the strain, dirt spewed up, and like a giant sled the skids moved, along with the house, inch by inch. Mildred joined us. "Don't know where me kids is. Anyhow, I got a pot of pea soup and a whack of boiled dumplings on the back of the stove." We realized it was dinner time, but nobody stopped to eat. Things were going too well. "If that tractor cable parts," Nina said, "somebody's going to get killed." Now, she's from out of town and not used to our careless attitude toward safety. No sooner had she spoken than the steel cable parted with an awesome screech.
As God looks after children, no one was hurt. A new cable was hitched to the house, and it inched along again. And one man rushed up, saying, "Where's Sammy? I can't remember where I left him." We produced the child from a blanket we'd wrapped around him, and the father, obviously relieved, took him off, muttering, "What would his mother say if she'd known I'd mislaid him?" It was really awe-inspiring as the hours went by to see the way our neighbors used their ingenuity, how the tractor drivers handled the huge machines as if they were toys, maneuvering them precisely. One trundled down the hill and came up behind the house. One tractor pulled, the other pushed. Men rushed like demented, thrusting more and more logs under the foundation of the house as it turned slowly and finally faced its new home 100 yards below the road. And then it canted dangerously. Mildred said, "Oh, my lard, they never even took the dishes out of the cupboard, just tied the doors together." "Well, that's nothing," said Grandma Moll. "When they got the house off the foundation and started the hall, somebody looked in the kitchen and there was the cat sound asleep on the rocking chair." As the house turned and settled into its new home, the sun got low. Tired and dirty and hungry, the men of the village slowed up a bit. They'd given a day's work to their neighbor, and soon they would help him straighten the house and clean up the yard. For tonight, the family would sleep at a 20-degree list, but the enormous job had been done successfully. Not long after lobstering was over, we had a time in the lodge. All the girls in the village turned out in their finery. They had sent away to Eaton's catalogue and had it come. The boys had haircuts and new ties. Upstairs in the lodge, a spread was set, such food as only village women could produce. Homemade bread and butter, hundreds of different kinds of little cakes, pies of many berries from last year's crop and preserved till now in bottles, gallons of tea and indifferent coffee. We ate in layers, as Taylor said, and he happened to be in my layer. The ladies of the lodge hustled in and out of the kitchen, breathing down our neck. "More tea, me dear? Now don't make shy. Make up your supper." And similar encouragements. While one layer ate, the others sat in rows along the walls of the big room, men on one side, women on the other, except for a few brave hussies who persisted in taking vacant chairs on the men's side. Two local belles, middle-aged but not admitting to it, sailed in just late enough for everyone to notice. One was draped in an old foxskin with the head nestling under her double chin and a black net sprinkled with sequins on her glossy curls. The other wore a tight satin dress of electric blue. Both wore 4-inch heels to which they were unaccustomed. Taylor nudged me. "Now," he said, "if you was as smart as them, you wouldn't go around looking like a streel." "Well, is that what everyone thinks around here, that I don't do them justice by dressing up properly? Well, that's just terrible." "Ha," he said, "I was only making fun. You'll do all right, I dare say. But only t'other day a feller seen you swimming off the wharf. He told me he seen someone getting out of the water, and my God, some was after painting her brown." Of course, I said it was only that you went around in the sun with hardly nothing on. The music started up downstairs. A fiddle, an accordion and a guitar, and the sets commenced. Now that was where my two ladies shone. They knew every step, and they pushed their partners like a coastal boat shoving a dory. And then the modern dancing started. Taylor peered. He shook his head. He couldn't possibly do that, he told Bill, but Bill said, "Oh, that's easy, only leapin' broadside." So Bill and I leapt broadside, jiggled up and down, shuffled our feet, and I walked backwards till my toes were trodden to pulp. Taylor thought he'd wait till Emmy came around to try the new dance, 'cause she'd be easier to shove round because she was only half my size. The dust rose higher, the room got smokier, the men got drunker, and the laughter rose to the rafters. Em danced a reel with Ned and leaped a bit with Taylor, and then she said to me, "Much too good a night to be in here. Let's go." So down at the wharf was my newly acquired boat, 12 feet long, broad in the beam, good for rowing or sailing. We pushed off, hoisted the sail, and went skimming along in the moonlight. The water burned in our wake. Lines of light formed round our fingers as we trailed them over the side. A distant gull complained once, and then all was silence, except for the lapping of the water at our bow. And we sailed until the stars dimmed and the dawn began to break. By then the party at the lodge had broken up, but small groups still lingered here and there. Down by the lighthouse, where the circling beams of light spread out over the village street, the drunkest of the old boys were rolling around. "Best not to go down," Em said. "We'd cramp their style." "You suppose they can get home by themselves?" I asked. And just then we heard Bill's deep voice. "Hoist up me leg, boys. Ah, hoist it up. 'Tis dead." Grunts, laughter, and then another voice. "What you firkin' round for?" "Ah, me bottle. Where's me bottle?" "Ah, you drank it. Hey, you ever hear the story about the feller getting his rum to Deer Lake one winter before we had the liquor store there, and we had to get it by express from St. John's? Well, he went up on the dog team, and 'twas some slippery. He got his bottle of rum, put it in his pants pocket, and when he come out of the office, he fell down. He got up then, felt all up and down his leg, and then he looked at his hand and said, 'Oh, thank God, 'tis only blood.'" Gales of laughter rang over the quiet village. Windows opened and banged shut, and then a shrouded figure emerged from the house next door and flitted down toward the lighthouse. The beam of light swung around, and standing before the knot of jolly drunks was the loveliest ghost I've ever seen, and the silence then was broken only by the sound of feet crunching on gravel as one sad drunk swayed homeward along the road in the angry embrace of his ghostly wife. One Saturday, a few weeks later, when I returned to my cottage after my morning's fishing, I saw four women leaning over my fence. They looked well-scrubbed and immaculate in light blue jeans and fancy, expensive-looking jackets. As I walked to my gate, the older woman said, "Ah, what a glorious view you have." Now, I love everyone who loves my view, so I replied, "Really, you ought to drive up into the gulch. Now, that's something spectacular." They said that, unfortunately, they hadn't a car, and before I could think, I'd bundle them into my dirty, fish-bespattered car, and off we went. They were enchanted. The younger ones climbed the pimple, the little green mound off the road, and found exotic plants. They took photographs, while their mother and I sat cozily behind a boulder out of the wind and talked about fishing and how you get to remote streams and what fun it is to live outdoors. Finally, they said they had to go back to pick up some lobsters for dinner. So I dropped them at Bill's store and went on to the cafe to tell Em about my morning's fishing. And there I met Stuart, who was standing in the middle of the road, arms akimbo, beady eyes shining. He looked me up and down and said, "Some class to you, my dear." I laughed. "Sure, some class, but why this morning particularly?" "Oh, my lard," he breathed in awe. He peered at me closely and said, "Don't you know what you're after doing?" He lifted his arm dramatically and pointed to the wharf. "Look!" I looked, and there, tied up, was the loveliest, shiniest, richest sailing boat it's ever been my privilege to see. "When did she get in?" I asked. "Well, last night. You mean you never seen her this morning?" "No, no, no. I went straight to the gulch. Whose is she?" "Belongs to them people you had up in the tablelands in your dirty old car." "My maid, them people was the Rockefellers." Now, I don't know why this was so excruciatingly funny to all the village, but all summer long, someone was telling someone else the story, ending up with, "And Ella took the Rockefellers up to the gulch and never asked who they were." You could hear shots of affectionate laughter clear across the bay, as if to say, God only knows what the old girl will be doing next. Now that August is here, it seems that summer is almost over. It's been a particularly good one as far as weather goes. Lately, I've been engaged in such unhousewifely occupations that I find it hard sometimes to bring my mind back to home and cooking. I have, in short, been sailing my new boat. Mind you, it's a small rowboat and it doesn't sail very fast, but it's been a source of great pleasure. Now, on the east coast of Newfoundland, where I was brought up, we called it a rodney. But here, on the west coast, they call it a punt, and they're not very polite about it either. Here, everyone uses a flat-bottomed dory, and they look askance at my round-bottomed craft. On the other hand, I remember that around Lewisport, when I was young, we thought a dory was the most treacherous of boats. One Bombay fisherman, predicting dire results, compared my boat with a barrel, claiming that she'd tip over very easily. But another fisherman dared us to turn her over. He said it couldn't be done, for the bottom was too wide. So you see, I've been the center of much interest with my Rodney, and I've learned a great deal about boats from people who've practically lived in them. Now, I hasten to tell you, we haven't managed to tip our boat yet, though several times we've been out in a stiff wind. After a bit, the novelty of rowing wore off, and we said, "Why don't we put a sail on her? Let's see what she'll do under canvas." So while the boys had a rudder rigged and a mast cut and fit, I bought some calico, cut and sewed a sail, and rigged it with pieces of jigger line. You can imagine what it looked like. Still, I was right proud of my handiwork, especially when a fisherman told me I had just the right amount of canvas on her. And another fisherman said it reminded of him when he was a boy, for I had cut and made a leg of mutton sail, like they used years ago. That pleased me, for I thought, here we are doing the same things our ancestors did. Here is my lad out on the bay enjoying himself in the same way that his grandparents and great-grandparents did before him. It brought us into the life around us more closely than anything else done so far. And then I began to think of all the arts and crafts that our grandparents had that we have almost lost. My grandfather, when he was my older son's age, could sail a dory, fish with the men, clean and cure and dry his fish, could saw and cleave wood, mend the roof, and chances are, if driven to it, could build a house, at least a good strong shed. Now my sons know about radio and about electricity, but I doubt they could do many of the things our ancestors did without thinking about them. And the same goes for our girls. Grandma could make bread, cook for a family, sew and clean house and hook mats before she was 14. Of course, I'm not saying that we should work our children all day long and make them do all these things, but I do think it would be wonderful if we could pass on some of our craftsmanship to them. For baking a good loaf of bread is as honest and important a craft as anything I can think of. And what could be of more lasting beauty, of more lasting joy and comfort, than a well-conceived pattern of delicate colors in a hooked rug? Now I wish I could hook a mat the way my grandmother and my mother did, and I wish I had the knack of growing house plants that the old people had. None of this may have anything to do with keeping a house clean or cooking the proper food to keep the family healthy, but it's part of making a home, part of keeping alive the habits, customs, and traditions of our people. Fortunate are we who have our roots deep in the land that belonged to our grandparents and great-grandparents, in land that we care for and build on and develop. You can see it in all the little settlements along our coast, in places where the people have hardly ever moved outside, but where they have learned the ways of the old people, why they did the things they did at any particular time, the whys of the wind and the tides, the days you go fishing and the days it would be useless to try, the days you start picking your berries to bottle against the winter, the recipes you use for your pickles and jams and wines. And you'll hear them tell their children the lore of their ancestors. The key is as simple as this. I said to my son in his sailboat, "Your great-grandfather once sailed from Exploits to Twillingate in a boat like this, alone on a dark night, to bring a doctor to your grandfather, who was then a very sick little boy." Now, that meant something to my son then, but it wouldn't have a week ago before he learned something of our ancient craft and developed a respect for the courage and strength and knowledge needed to handle a craft well in a windy sea. I think when I'm very, very old, I shall enjoy telling my grandchildren everything I know about our past, about this most wonderful summer in Woody Point, and all the things I've learned along the way. And if I am any judge of the curiosity of children, I'd say they'll listen with awe.
That was me, Anthony Berger, reading a story by the late L. Emanuel, from the podcast series Down to Sally's Cove. This was recorded in the studios of VOBB, the Voice of Bombay Community Radio in the heart of Grosmore National Park in western Newfoundland. Recording engineer and sound editor was Gary Wilton. Background music from Coffee in the Cove, written and played by David Berger. Together with a biography of my mother, These and other stories are available in book form entitled No Place for a Woman, The Life and Newfoundland Stories of Ella Manuel, published in 2020 by Breakwater Books, St. John's, Newfoundland and Labrador. Thanks for listening.